Welcome to American Gypsy Podcast. I'm your host, Gypsy, and today we have a special guest, Thomas Westenholt. He is an author, a couples therapist specializing in attachment theory, and facilitator in psychedelics, breathwork, and ecstatic dance. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm excited about this conversation today, and I'm impressed with how you pronounce my name, which is not easy.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard that before. Where are you coming from?
Well, I grew up in Denmark originally, and now I'm based in the United Kingdom. But I think it has some German roots. I think the last names, I don't know what my Viking ancestors obviously did to get that name, but that's a different podcast.
Yeah. So before we get started, introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so I think as you obviously briefly mentioned, I'm trained as a couple therapist and I work with couples in something called emotional focused couple therapy, which is very much based on attachment theory. And again, a lot of listeners might not know what attachment theory is, but essentially it's a framework for understanding how we learn to relate to our caregivers and how these patterns then play out again and again in adult relationships, especially if we don't have an awareness and how they tend to get us stuck in certain cycles. And it's also the most researched and effective couple therapist modality that there is, and have about an 80% success rate long term, which is really, really impressive. And then, of course, I combined that with, I trained at something called Synthesis Institute and also done training with the Mind Foundation in Berlin in psychedelic assisted therapy, which obviously is a very new modality that still is not legal in many countries. However, more and more trainings are popping up because we anticipate the legalization is going to happen quite soon. So yeah, that's a little bit about the background.
Nice. So what is attachment theories and how does that affect our relationship?
So that's a really good question. And I think if we can think of it as adaptive strategies, so we are born into this world with a very blank slate. You know, we're the mammals that take the longest to grow up and become self-sufficient, right? Of any species, basically. Most animals within a week, a month, a few years are already up and running on their own, doing their own thing, right? While we take probably about 18 years, minus plus some years, right? And that's because we are created biologically to be very, very adaptable. And what that means is we adapt very much to our environment and we are designed to do this. But it also means that what happens very early in our life forms certain structures for how we relate to the world. And this is what attachment theory really is all about and attachment styles. So they identified four key patterns that defined how we interact with other people and respond to other people, especially under stress. And you can then identify these patterns, and that will then tell you a lot about how you relate to other people and why you relate to other people in these ways. And it also makes it possible to then break some of those patterns that we might get stuck in that are not very constructive.
What are the different types of attachment styles?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, there's four key attachment styles really that they have identified. And I think what's important to say before diving into this is, the attachment styles is not who we are. And also there's a good reason for why we have these attachment styles. Because when people often hear it, they start blaming themselves and they say, oh, that's me, I'm faulty, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's important to just say there's absolutely nothing wrong with people, even if they have an attachment style that might be more challenging to live with and interact with other people. They adapted this because they needed it in that environment, right? So I think it's important to realize it was a dysfunctional environment. It doesn't mean that they're a dysfunctional person, right? These strategies worked and kept them alive at that stage in their life. And now they might be blocking them from connecting with other people. So the four main attachment styles, the first one is called secure attachment. And that's, you know, about 50% of the population as an estimation have been lucky enough to be gifted with this in the way that they had parents that were quite responsive to them, that acknowledgement, that respected their boundaries. And they learned to trust that the world would basically respond to them in a constructive, positive way, that they would respond to their needs and also respect their boundaries. These people feel very safe both being on their own. They feel very safe being in intimate relationships. So they're not afraid of intimacy. They're very good at expressing their needs because they feel, you know, they anticipate other people will respond in a positive way. They're quite good with their boundaries. So those are, you know, you can say some lucky people that, you know, had upbringings that provided that for them. However, there's also a huge chunk of the population that didn't necessarily have this, right? And that's where we come into what's categorized as a more anxious, where there's more anxiety, more sympathetic arousal, it's called. And the first one of these is called that name, anxious attachment. And if we look at this, it's a typical person who would anticipate or worry about being abandoned. We often, I don't like this term, we often call them needy. I don't like it because there's a lot of judgment in that term. So I really want to get rid of it because actually, again, as I said, these strategies that developed kept them alive and were really suitable at the time of being a small child, right? So they might have had a parent who left them, maybe the dad left, whatever it might have been, that created this anxiety, right? That the person would suddenly leave. And that can often lead to that they're very critical, that they really need constant validation from their partner. And often they tend to ruminate a lot. They tend to people please a lot because they have learned as a strategy, which is a form response, that to keep people liking them or engaging, they had to people please. And these were strategies they had to apply as a child. So there's a good reason they have them. But it often means they experience a lot of anxiety because they often worry about being left. You know, they will often think, oh, my partner might be cheating on me or et cetera, et cetera. And they often do a lot of rumination if they go through a breakup, meaning they keep thinking and thinking, what could I have done different? And they tend to self-blame as well. So they will take on all the blame for what didn't work out, instead of maybe what a securely attached person would have a bit more of a balanced view, and they wouldn't ruminate for so long. They would say, okay, I made some mistake, this person, and then they would move on with life. But the anxious tend to ruminate for a long time. They might still a year later be ruminating, what could I have done different, right? And that can be a very challenging attachment style to obviously live with for these reasons. And they also really struggle being on their own. So they tend to really quickly need to try and find another partner because they regulate their nervous system through other people. They didn't learn to self-regulate very well. Then we have avoidant attachment. And we often say this is men, but I just want to be clear, it can be any gender. These are not gender-based. And avoidant attachment, if you remember, there was this whole time where we said to parents, just leave your children to cry in a crib. Don't attend to them when they cry because then they won't learn to become independent. We now know from research that this was horrible advice because what happened was that that child's nervous system got so dysregulated when it was crying and the blood pressure was going on that at some point the child internal system already knew that it was in danger because if it continued, it would become so dysregulated, it would become harmful. So it had to shut it down. And what it did, it is shut down its need and it learned people are not going to respond. I'm on my own in this world. Yeah. And a child can't make logical sense. So this just happened on an emotional, neurological level. I'm on my own. And that's what you see in avoidance. They don't like intimacy. You know, anything that's too close, they talk constantly about individualism, right? They really glorify and value when they're stressed, they want to be on their own. Because they have learned to the opposite of the anxious attachment. They learn to regulate only themselves and only trust themselves. And you can also think that why do they not want to be vulnerable in a relationship? Well, it makes sense if as a small child to learn that nobody was going to respond anyway. Why would you put yourself out there at risk of being vulnerable, right? So they tend to not trust other people that much. They trust themselves more, but not other people so much. And again, they tend to find it hard, as I said, being in intimate relationships, etc. Then we have the last one, which is a mixture of these two at a very extreme spectrum. So it's attachment style most closely linked to trauma. And it's what's called disorganized. And they tend to show up first in a very anxious attachment style, meaning closeness. They want closeness all the time. And then when they get that closeness, they panic and they become the avoidant at the extreme scale and they push people away completely because they obviously had trauma very early. So they needed their caregiver, but they were also afraid of their caregiver, right? And that creates this really complicated, difficult dynamic where they really get stressed and anxious and want closeness very quick, very intense. But when they get it, they panic and they run away or they push the other person away. And it can be very difficult to live with that attachment styles. But luckily, you know, we can help people if they come into therapy, et cetera.
And I know this is something you develop, a lot of this is developed in childhood, but is it something that if you have awareness, does it change or is it something that can change over time or you just learn to understand and deal with yourself from that perspective?
It's a really good question. And this is why, you know, luckily we are not defined by our attachment style. And luckily, you know, we used to think that the brain developed for a certain amount of years and then it was kind of just how we were. And while certainly we do become more rigid, we know that the brain is plastic, meaning it can develop new connections throughout life. It doesn't end in childhood. It just becomes less so in adulthood. So yes, and we also know from research that we can change attachment styles and also seen this in practice. However, what often need to are required is that the people who maybe have more of these anxious attachment styles, spend time with people that have more secure nervous system, calm nervous system, regulated nervous systems, because the people we spend time with has a huge influence on our nervous system, right? So if we continue to spend a lot of time with other people that are very dysregulated, we are unlikely to rewire our own nervous system. And with the right awareness, and with the right help, you can also see, even if two people are together that have some of these anxious attachment, that actually together they can break that dynamic through awareness. They can notice, oh, we're going into these patterns again. My presumption is that you're cheating because you didn't call me for an hour, but actually I'm now aware that that's just a presumption. What is it actually I need so I don't go attack my partner, right? Which tend to create a conflict and then pulling away. Then maybe instead I can say, you know what? I felt really insecure tonight when I didn't hear from you. Would it be okay if you check in with me when you're out with your friends? And that will get a very different response, right? Than the anxious attack that might come out in blame or accusations, etc. So yes, with that awareness, we can start changing that dance to a very different dance that's more secure.
Do you feel like that's something we should look at when we're looking at romantic relationships? Are attachments theories something we should look at in terms of compatibility, or is it just something we should understand so that we can handle our partners better?
Yeah, I like that question. So I think, yes, again, I don't want to say that just because people are two certain attachment styles, it can't work, because nobody can make that statement, right? And that would be too broad. However, we do know there are certain attachment styles that gel much, much easier together. A bit like if you are a couple who have the same love language, you both love touch, it just gels a bit easier. It doesn't mean you can't be with somebody who have a different love language, but it certainly is easier when you have the same one, right? Because if one like touch, the other one don't, then there will often be this gap of dissatisfaction. And it's a bit the same here. So we know the most problematic matchup of attachment style is anxious and avoidant. And that's because one seek more closeness, proximity, and need to co-regulate. The other one is afraid of the intimacy and want to self-regulate, right? So therefore, they often get caught in this cycle where the anxious is chasing, the avoidant then feel even more stressed and pull away. That make the anxious even more anxious, right? Because it validate, right. Oh, I'm going to be abandoned. Then the one get, oh my God, I'm going to be even more, you know, smothered. And then they pull away even further. And the cycle go on and on until they both feel so helpless and not met that they, you know, come into a therapy office or they leave each other. So this is definitely the most challenging dynamic and the one we see most often in couple counseling.
So how do you incorporate these theories into your couples counseling?
So there's a few steps that you normally go through when they come in. First is to try and identify what is this cycle. Because, you know, I really like the terminology. If you imagine it as a dance and we are out on the dance floor, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe in the beginning, we're falling in love and we're playing the same tune, the same beat. So it kind of flows, right? We're moving around and it feels good. It's fun. But then suddenly, without us noticing, as we get further into the relationship, we now are playing different tunes in our headphones. I don't know what you're playing. You don't know what I'm playing. And suddenly I'm stepping on your feet all the time and it doesn't gel anymore, right? Because we are listening to different tunes. And that's what tend to happen. So we first understand what is the cycle, because there's, you know, about three cycles that people get stuck in, and they pretty much always fit within, you know, one of these cycles. And when we identify, what we can do is we can externalize the enemies. So instead of them making each other the enemy, which is what happens when they come in, you know, he's so bad, or oh, she never did the dirty, criticized me, and they're stuck in this pattern, right? Then we can slow that down and say, look, there's nobody here who is the bad guy or the bad woman. It's this dance that's the enemy. And then that makes it easier for them to come together and feel now we're a team against this external thing that is not working, that's ruined. So that's number one. Then you kind of deepen, because often people are not even in touch with what are these core attachment needs. It tend to come out in blame or withdrawal or anger, whatever it might be, right? Because we're not aware what is actually on. And it might be the typical argument, oh, you didn't take out the bin, you know, and people come in and think that their relationship is falling apart over a bin. It's never the bin that's causing the relationship to deteriorate. Is that maybe he didn't hear that underneath what she actually needs is she's feeling alone. She feels she's doing everything. She feels, and that's an attachment need, right? We have a need to feel I'm here with another and I'm not alone in this world and I'm valuable. So very often, because people aren't aware, they miss that. And what we then help them is become aware, what are these underlying attachment need that you actually need? Because it's not about that he forgot the bin, right? That's not why you're throwing your marriage out the house. So it's because of this, they feel somehow alone, both of them, right? And when they can then understand that and communicate that in a vulnerable way, because we help obviously make that safe in the room and make sure they don't get attacked when they do, then suddenly they can start hearing each other, what their actual needs are. And when these attachment needs are met, we get what a small child who has secure attachment, they express their need, they cry, mommy or daddy come and give them food or blanket, child calms down, right? Because the nervous system is, oh, I have responsiveness, I can, that's what happened with adults too. So when these core needs are met, the nervous system calms down and the fight, the conflict, they stop because they're no longer necessary anymore. And then you can start a totally new cycle, right? It's like you get them back dancing again, but to the same song.
Yeah, because communication is really the biggest issue in relationships. Because personally, I think that was what was lacking in my marriage. And then over time, when it's not dealt with, you get to the point of no return. So I think if I actually had understood maybe some of these, you know, communication needs or attachment theory, I think maybe it could be handled a little bit better, because there was constant communication, but it wasn't really going anywhere. Because I think both partners were not understanding what the attachment theory was. So they didn't understand that what the other partners needed. So I can definitely understand that.
And it takes two people, right? It takes two people to tango or dance. If one person is self-reflecting, want to understand and want to learn to communicate their attachment need, and the other person doesn't, it's still not really going to work, right? That's like one person dragging the other one around on the dance floor and one person refused to move their feet, right? It's still not going to be a dance that feels good. So both people need to be willing to move their feet, right? And yes, sometimes we'll step each other, but then we recalibrate and, oh, we were out of beat. And then they come back, right? And I really think it's about, when we say communication, it's about what we communicate about, right? Because we can even say shouting at each other is also communication, but it's obviously not getting us anywhere, right? Or even saying nothing is a silence, is a form of communication. But again, it's leaving another one, the other feeling alone, right? And this is really what it's about, because we're in partnership, in a romantic relationship, because we are wired to be not alone. We are wired as a social species, right? This is why we stay together even after we raise children. We don't really biologically need to be together, right? The kids are grown up, they're doing, but couples still try and want to stay together and they still want to be in relationship when they have grown kids, because we are wired to be social and to have companionship throughout life. And you can even say, to some extent, that an adult partner replace the attachment bond we had with a parent. Of course, there's now, as an adult, also a romantic element, but we forgot that we also need the safety element. And I really think, especially in Western culture, I know you're based in the US, which almost have glorified this idea of individuality. It's like, I can do everything on my own, and then you get a pat on the back. And we wonder why we have so many mental health issues, right, in the Western world, which is increasing and increase. Well, that's a huge part of it, that we think we're meant to do everything on our own. And no, we're meant to do it in companionship, in partnership, in community, together with other people. That's how we actually flourish. And this need is with us from the day we are born till the day we go to the grave.
Now, I know you mentioned earlier about psychedelics and how that plays into our relationships and our personal development. How did you get into looking into psychedelics in this perspective?
So I guess for me, my first interest in psychedelics actually came from a different, but you can still say an attachment perspective. So I have a son who's very, very unwell most of the time and have a very, very severe medical condition. And we still spend an enormous amount of time in hospital. And he has what they call a life-limited condition. So this was something that I couldn't come to terms with, despite all my different skill sets and training and support network. I couldn't come to terms with that. Maybe one day I had to put my son to the grave, right? That was too hard for me to actually accept. And so I looked at other things, and I stumbled upon a research study where cancer patients, actually here in London, were given psychedelics to try and deal with their anxiety about dying. And something incredibly happened in that research that most of the participants, their anxiety actually went away. And they ended up having, they still died, but they had a beautiful quality of life in the remaining time they had left because they had somehow transcended this experience of just this physical body, right? And a connection to others. And that suddenly gave them a sense of calm that they could enjoy. And that's what really first propelled me into it and also made me do a session with a therapist. And it just really changed my nervous system and made me able to be much more present. Much more embrace my love for my son than I could before, because fear that before were primarily dominating this idea, or I could lose him, so it's scary to love him, right? That just calmed down, and suddenly I was able to engage with him and love him in a much more full way because I had that. And then I started obviously studying and understanding all the huge benefits that we are now discovering through research that psychedelics can have. And it certainly have a space. So they're also researching it actually in couples therapy at the moment with MDMA. And it has actually got a breakthrough approval from the FDA in the US, which has never happened before, which means that it can be speeded up and hopefully quicker get full approval. And it's showing really promising results because what MDMA does is it lowers the part of the brain, activity in the part of the brain that's responsible for the fear response, right? And when we're stuck in a place we can't get out of with our partner, it's because the fear response suddenly is very triggered and activated a lot of the time when we communicate, right? That means we can no longer hear each other. There's just no way to go if fear's online. It hijacks your brain, and all it cares about is survival. Fear doesn't care about relating or being intimate or feeling close. It cares about survival, right? And MDMA shuts down this part of the brain so we can sit and have conversations with our partner without fear being in the picture. And that opens up the possibility of some really incredible breakthroughs, right? And in terms of self-development, I think, yes, first of all, psychedelics, there's primarily early research also showing it can actually help rewire anxious attachment style into a more secure attachment style. And it makes our nervous system much more calm. It makes us feel more connected to others. And it can even produce fundamental personality changes. And most of all, because most of our problems stems from the fact that we grow up and become very rigid. There's even a part in the front part of your brain, it's called the default mode network, which is where we form a sense of identity. That basically means all the experiences you had throughout your life, or I had throughout my life, they get stored in here and that decide this is who I am, right? And it dictate our behavioral patterns, our choices. And often we are so rigid in this is who I am that it's really difficult to change and go in new directions because we can't even see the possibilities, right? Because this is who I am. What psychedelics, especially, things like LSD, psilocybin, which is magic mushrooms, is they found out it actually shuts down activity in that part of the brain that stores our identity. And what that does, it has opened up flexibility. And all these different brain parts that normally don't speak to each other suddenly start connecting and communicating because this governor is being put quiet. You can almost imagine that it's like it's the president of a country who dictate what's going to happen and the policies, right? And we feel kind of trapped within those policies because we feel we can't do much. We feel very disempowered. Suddenly we shut that down. And all the other can speak to each other, right? And that suddenly allow the flexibility to create change and grow and really adapt in a new way and see new perspectives of self, of others. So it has huge potential as well for being something we can use in self-development.
Yeah, and I think I remember seeing that research you mentioned years ago about the terminally ill patients, and they were given, I think it was mushrooms. And
Yes.
That's when I first got introduced to the idea, the beneficial things about mushrooms. And that kind of made me look into it a little bit more. But it's not necessarily legal everywhere, but there are some states that and some cities that are making it legal now, for research at least, and for recreational.
You know, I think it's really is incredible if we're looking at some of the research founding. So I guess very relevant to now, the time we're living in, the conflict with, you know, between Israel and the Palestinians, is that there was actually a research project that was done as well with psychedelics, where they took Israelis and Palestinians together that had a lot of animosity towards each other. And again, if you think about where animosity comes from, it can only exist if there's a differentiation, meaning I feel you're different, right? And we create all these categories. You're a woman, I'm a man, you have this color, I have this color, you have this religion. We create all these things to separate us, right? And this is where conflict exists. There has to be something to separate it for there to be conflict, right? And the amazing thing was, and this is again part of this identity that makes me think I'm this religion, I'm this, right? That makes me feel I'm separate from others. And they gave them ayahuasca in this group. And again, the beautiful thing is because it shuts down this part that tells us all these identities that we are, when that no longer is there, all we can see is common humanity. And guess what happened? Their animosity towards each other disappeared, not only while they were on it, but also in follow-up afterwards. And they were able to sit down and have dialogue and listen to each other and feel empathetic for the struggle that each other have faced instead of seeing each other as an enemy. And it just shows a tiny gap of the huge potential that this has, you know, not only for personal development, but also for global development of how we relate to other people and can see the common humanity instead of seeing other people as different or the enemy or all these narratives that we are told.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting perspective I didn't think about. I know that, you know, it's beneficial in breaking down your egos, but yeah, when you look at it from a global perspective, it is interesting. I know you recommend psychedelics in terms of when you're doing your couples therapy work, but is it something that you are able to facilitate in where you are, or is it something you can recommend?
That's an interesting question. So I would say it's obviously always individual from person to person, and also there's lots of screenings that have to take place. So for a lot of people, this is not the right solution. And for me, psychedelics is never, because I know a lot of people use it recreational or for other reasons, and again, that's totally up to them. However, for me, that's not the use that I'm focused on. So there's for a lot of cases where it's not, I think, a good idea. So to give you an example, I had somebody come and tell me, oh, I had a breakup and I feel really sad. Can I take psychedelics? Because I don't want to feel sad. And I said, I don't think that's a good idea, because feeling sad is a very natural and healthy response to go through when a relationship has broken down. And psychedelic isn't here to try and numb us out of the human experience. And actually, it doesn't. Antidepressants tend to numb emotional experience. Psychedelics actually tend to enhance emotional experience. So I said, I don't think that's the appropriate. And again, I think people need to go through other means of trying to deal with what they are. And for me, psychedelics is kind of the last step. When people come and say, you know, I tried all this, it doesn't work, then maybe psychedelics can be useful. And here in the UK, no, I cannot do it. MDMA is not allowed, well, pretty much anywhere to my knowledge. I think it's illegal pretty much everywhere, because the UN made it illegal from pressure from the US government, made it so. So MDMA we cannot do legally at this stage, anywhere that I'm familiar with. However, psilocybin you can in certain places. So in the Netherlands, which is not too far here from the UK, that is possible, because you can get what's called truffles, which is similar to magic mushrooms. It contains psilocybin. It's just slightly different, but it has the same compound basically at magic mushroom. And you can buy that in smart shops, and it's permissible to consume, etc. So it's possible to do over there. I know there are certain people that do obviously MDMA therapy underground, but that's obviously something they have to choose at their own risk, whether they want to do or not, right? I think one of the things I do want to mention just from a harm perspective, right, to also make sure people do this carefully, is that people need to do proper research when doing this, because, you know, even though they are quite safe, the harm that happens is people doing this really carelessly. So that could be in really wrong environments. The people that have been harmed are people, for example, that do it in a hot nightclub. They take MDMA, they dance all night, they forgot to drink water, and they overheat. And that can be dangerous, right? Or the other problem, people don't have somebody there who is not under the influence of something, which really would be a good idea. So they end up drinking too much water, which can also become dangerous. Or it's mixing different substances together that shouldn't be mixed, right? Or it's buying off the street from somebody and not actually knowing what's in there. Because when people go out and maybe buy a pill of MDMA, they don't know the purity. They don't know where that comes from. And that can be full of a lot of other things that are really harmful or don't mix well, right? So this is where, again, you know, it's good to talk to a professional or somebody who know what they're doing before considering doing these things to make sure that certain safety precautions are taken. Because in research settings, it's extremely safe. Extremely safe, right? And that is because they do these things. They do screenings on people beforehand. They, of course, know exactly what they give is completely pure, right? So all, and they, again, they have the aftercare. They monitor, they have a person sitting there and monitoring you. You don't do it alone. So they put a lot of precautions in place, which is why it's very safe and also very effective. And when we disregard them, then of course there is some element of risk, right? So I just really recommend that if people want to do this, and of course they have to check whether it's legal or not legal, or what risk they want to take in wherever they live, that's up to them. But I would still recommend speaking to people who actually know, professionals that actually know what they're dealing with, so they can get good guidance. And I know there's different test kits, both in the US but also here in Europe, that you can buy, where, for example, you can test the purity and not what's actually in whatever it is that you are getting, which I would always recommend doing.
Yeah, I don't think I knew what fell under the umbrella of psychedelics. You feel like certain psychedelics work better when in terms of dealing with attachment theories and interpersonal development.
So it's an interesting question. So I think, you know, LSD and magic mushrooms, which is psilocybin, it's very, very similar. So they work on the same receptors in the brain, basically. So they're very, very similar compounds. The main difference between the two is that LSD lasts for about 8 hours or more, while magic mushrooms tend to last 4 to 5 hours approximately. Then the effect will really wear off. So they wear a bit less time. So I would say it's probably safer to deal with magic mushrooms. It's more easier to source something that's pure than it is to buy a pill of LSD, for example. And also not just because of that, but it's also shorter time. So if people were to have a challenging experience, it doesn't last as long, right? Which can be beneficial for people who haven't done stuff before. And I would still say they should always make sure they have a safe set and setting, right? And not just go do it in some random place with random people. That's not a safe place to expand your consciousness, right? And let go of control. So I think, you know, there's not research on specific psychedelics that necessarily are better at changing attachment styles than others. But I think things like MDMA is used in couples therapy and a therapy in general. It's becoming something that's very well researched, because it doesn't really send you off into a place where you have hallucinations or where you're not able to be coherently there. You can still really be there, have a coherent conversation. It's just the fear response is really lowered, right? However, it doesn't seem to have some of the benefits of things like magic mushrooms or LSD, where it can really shut down your sense of identity and your ego and allow to really expand that flexibility of mind. So in that way, they can work in different ways. But I would say, you know, it's always good to have what's called a sitter there, which is somebody who's not under the influence of anything, that you really trust, who you feel safe with, who is sitting there and just looking out for you, right? And who can take care of your safety as well and make sure you don't do any stupid things as well.
Yeah. And I know with, at least with psilocybin, there's different effects whether you're microdosing or you're taking it at higher levels. Do you feel like that matters when you're in this perspective?
Yes, it really does, hugely. So, if we look at microdosing, because microdosing have become very popular. And again, it's a bit of this Hollywood concept. I think it started with you know, it's cool to microdose. The fact is, scientifically, and I'm not talking about people's individual experience, which might differ, and people might have had different experience with this, but scientifically, and I actually spoke to a researcher just a couple of weeks ago who's in the middle of doing research on this, there's no clear benefit of microdosing. And when compared to a group that didn't get it, it's they found that the placebo effect is as effective as taking microdosing, meaning that people who microdose, and I'm not saying nobody got better, but it what science is pointing to is it's a placebo effect. It's simply, which can be very powerful, by the way, it's simply that they believe what they're taking will make them better, and that actually does make them a bit better, right? We can never underestimate placebo effect. In most research study on into antidepressants, the placebo effect actually outperformed antidepressants. So even the idea of taking something you think will make you better is really, really powerful. So there's no evidence that microdosing actually really significantly helps, which, like I said, we still need to do more research on this to obviously be certain and know for sure. But so far, and what they have found is the long-term benefits of psychedelics tend to be at slightly higher doses, which of course is different for different compounds. And again, seek professional advice on this, which is really, really important to dose correctly and to do it very safely. But yes, I think for what they found is when you have these, what they call peak experiences, or where you sense have a sense of loss of identity, or suddenly have a more profound experience, which is on more higher doses, then that tend to correlate with more long-term changes and positive outcomes.
That's interesting, because like personally, I get a lot of benefits, I feel like, from microdosing. It's not as overwhelming, like you said, the loss of identity that comes from a higher dose, which is, I mean, it's beneficial for sure to kind of look at things from a different perspective. It's very eye-opening, but microdosing, it I don't feel like it's a placebo effect personally, because it's sometimes I forgot that I microdosed, and I catch myself having a lot of realizations, or it feels like it's a lot of puzzle pieces. You didn't know how it connected in your brain, and it just, you get a lot of aha moments. And then I realized, oh yeah, I forgot I microdosed. And so, you know, personally, I don't feel like it's, I do recognize the different benefits that it has, you know, having an eye-opening, crazy a realization versus like small, how do I say it? But yeah, I definitely recognize the difference. I just thought microdosing would be more beneficial.
And you know, I think it's really valid point that you bring up here, because as I said, the research is really early and it's not conclusive. There hasn't been enough. So this, what I'm saying, was only what the initial research was indicating, right? That doesn't mean it's conclusive. And we have still so much to understand, you know, whether there hasn't been much research into the creativity element of microdosing, for example. Does it make us, like you're describing, more creative in our thinking, that we can see new solutions, new ideas? So there's still so much that we need to do, right? The initial research is so encouraging, and hopefully that will spark that more is going to happen, right, in the future, so we can continue to understand these substances better and can use them in safe and beneficial ways. Because we still don't know either how frequently should you take it if you microdose, you know, in what dosage, and as I said, the frequency. What breaks do we need to take? So people are kind of experimenting themselves and trying to figure out what works for them, right, on an individual basis. But it would be great if we have a better framework so we can kind of give people guidance on the most safe way of doing this.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing right now with a lot of these psychedelics, is being able to at least research them safely. Because I know I've even looked at ibogaine a long time ago, which helped so many people break addictions and long-term attachments that they've had. pretty much almost instantly. And I've talked to a couple of people on the podcast about ayahuasca and the life transformation that they've had. But a lot of times you're having to go to some other country and all of these things, and the research is limited. So I really look forward to seeing this change in the future globally.
Yeah, and you bring up a really good point, because often, as you said, people will then go on some retreats abroad to some effectively stranger, right?
Yeah.
And I would just say to people, be really mindful about this. Because yes, there's people who had good experiences, but I can also tell you stories of people who had horrible experiences, right? And I think we still have to remember, in research into traditional therapy, right, that in a traditional way we do talk therapy, showed that it's not the modality, it's a relationship with the therapist that's the most important. And I think it's a reasonable presumption to therefore also, you know, move this over to psychedelics, meaning that the person who is with you, it has a huge importance on the outcome, how safe and connected you feel to this person. And therefore, you know, besides the fact that it's a stranger and you don't really know them, what they might do when you completely let go or part of your mind, then there's also this element, how beneficial is it if it's not somebody you feel really, really safe with, right? How, you know, because that could make it much more likely to have a positive outcome if you're with someone you've known for many, many years, you trust really well, who can provide certain attachment comforts, you know, if you get into distress that maybe a stranger couldn't or shouldn't do, right? And also the fact that then you have somebody afterwards to integrate with, which is really important for the long-term impact of psychedelics. While when you go to retreat, you tend to go home, and then they're not there anymore, and you're kind of on your own, right? And that lose out on a lot of the benefits that we could have. So I think it's wise that you don't, you know, jump straight off on these retreats, because I think it's very much hit and miss what benefit people actually get out of it.
Yeah. Well, this has been a very enlightening conversation. I really appreciate your perspective and educating me on this topic. It's pretty new to me. Is there anything you want to get into before we close it out?
No, I hope we've given people a little overview and at least spark some curiosity, I guess, for people just to go study themselves. There's a lot of books on Amazon. You know, there's a lot of blogs that are writing on this, credible blogs, etc. Their MAPS is a really good organization to look into, who provides really good information, and they study psychedelics and do a lot of research into it. People can obviously go on my website if they want to listen more to my podcast on psychedelics or read articles. So I think it's just sparking a conversation where people start doing a bit more research instead of just taking random things in random places, right? Which actually might as well just be harmful, and do this in a bit more aware way of how they engage with these medicines, because they weren't really meant to just be let's go party. And like I said, I'm not judging people for doing that. I'm just saying that, you know, it's good to be mindful about how we engage with these substances.
Yeah, I don't feel like psychedelics are really a recreational drug. I know that's how it gets used a lot, but it's more of I see it as a shamanic experience or a introspective self-development type things. It's not something you can just use all the time recreationally.
Absolutely.
You can't escape the eye-opening or the transformative effect that it has on you.
Yes.
And I don't see how you can do that recreationally.
And I think you're spot on. And there can also be this where people almost start just chasing the next amazing experience, which in itself can become an escape from reality.
Yeah.
And that's not actually healing, right? I met people who are like, oh, I've been to 100 journeys. I said, great, but what do you actually bring back here in your day-to-day life? Because otherwise it's just another form of escape, right? And I think that's really important to be mindful of, because if psychedelics are used appropriate and in a quite more aware way, then it's not needed to continue to do psychedelic journey after psychedelic journey, right? And that's also what the research is showing. So it's not about chasing, I think, these peak experiences. It's about, if people want to engage with this, then taking back what they experience and finding ways they can integrate that into everyday life so they can actually have long-term impact and changes, right? Without needing to go back to psychedelics again and again and again.
Well, Thomas, thank you so much. And for the listeners, all the links and information that Thomas mentioned will be in the description, links to his website and books and all of that stuff. Thank you, Thomas, for gracing the podcast.
Oh, it was my pleasure, and thank you for hosting it.
Thank you. And as always, you can find us on all podcast platforms or AmericanGypsy.com. Thank you for listening. Peace.